Michael Andrew Dixon, isn't he?
That's right, Mickey Dixon. Better known to one and all as Mad Mickey.
But I thought he was tucked up, doing plenty of porridge.
Supposed to be, yeah. Only now he isn't. He had it on his toes from Chelmsford Nick this morning.
Oh, lovely. The press will have a field day.
Welcome to episode 27 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. This one is a little different, as you will no doubt have seen. So what's occurring? What's this all about? I've had a few requests for doing an episode deep dive and wasn't sure if I wanted to start that process as it could become addictive. But sometimes you come across something that you didn't expect from a surprising source. And in this case, it made me think this was one episode I could do that with. My wife, legend that she is, recently came back from the second-hand bookshop with the books I had mentioned I had seen that I wanted her to pick up. But she also grabbed a few others she thought I might like that I had missed. One of these was a book called The Enforcer, written by Albert Donoghue with Martin Short. Martin Short looks like an interesting bloke, by the way, and I intend to look more into his work. Short piece of related trivia before I carry on. Short died in 2020 and is buried in Highgate Cemetery. As you will know if you heard the Leon Griffiths tribute, the founder of Minder is buried there too. Okay, so let's get into it. I read The Enforcer in just a few sittings. It is a detailed book but fairly easy to read, very interesting and even funny in parts. Donoghue was a crazed confidant, and his book details how the pair really operated and gives great detail on the links to all the familiar names you might know if you have an interest in the craze. I am not particularly a fan of theirs, not one of these who thinks they are community idols or that we must show respect. I was already of the opinion that they were a creepy pair who were into much worse than we have been told, but that's another story or two. You can't escape the stories of interest as far as they are concerned, however, and this is one of them. But what does this all have to do with Minder anyway, you ask? What jumped out at me when reading the book was chapter 9. Big Frank meets the Big Sleep. Not only is it an incredible account of what actually happened to Big Frank Mitchell, it is an astonishing retelling of most of the Looking for Mickey plot, or should I say pre-telling, because this occurred in 1966. So if you're a fan of the Looking for Mickey episode from Series 3, you'll love this. I will read the chapter in full from the Albert Donoghue book and connect some dots as well as ask a few questions. It must be said that, of course, not all of it is just like the Minder episode. It does get a lot more intense, but it is a good enough story to justify going off here and there. Firstly, let us just cover the episode basics of Looking for Mickey. The episode was shown in early February 1982. Mickey is played by John Labanowski, or Labanowski, who bears a striking resemblance to Frank Mitchell before we even start. It's also obvious once you know. I'll just read the synopsis from Minder.org of the episode. An old boxing friend of Terry, Michael, Mad Mickey Dixon, has escaped from prison and seeks refuge with Debbie for short-term accommodation, while he attempts to sort a clear and definite release date, claiming he has been misrepresented. Meanwhile, Chisholm and Jones are about on the manor looking for leads, starting with local hard man and villain Freddie Baker, well acquainted with Mickey, and Arthur is busy selling houndstooth jackets. When Debbie calls on Terry for help, Arthur spots a way to make a nice little earner with a cutthroat top Fleet Street journalist. What Arthur doesn't realise is just how well acquainted the journalist is with a certain Freddie Baker, and the two set up about setting up their own scheme to get Mickey back in prison after he has provided a good news story. When Arthur is kidnapped by Baker and his heavies, he is forced to reveal where Mickey is held up. After completing his interview in Fleet Street, Baker sells Mickey out, and he is arrested immediately afterwards. When Chisholm spots Mickey wearing the same jacket as Dave and half the Winchester Club, he knows Arthur has been involved, but knows he just can't prove it. So let us examine the chapter from The Enforcer by Albert Donoghue. Chapter 9. Big Frank Meets the Big Sleep. I'd been on one visit to Dartmoor to see Big Frank Mitchell. I didn't know the guy, and I didn't have anything to say to him, but I sat there alongside Ronnie Cray as he promised that the twins would get Frank out. It was the least they could do for an old friend who felt the system wouldn't be letting him out for a long time, if ever. Poor Frank had been in the zoo since he was 17. He was now 37, 4 years older than the twins, who had both first met him in Wandsworth, though at different times around 1960. Frank had a long record for violent crime, especially for violence against prison officers. He was mentally subnormal, and he'd been deemed insane. He'd been to Rampton, he'd been to Broadmoor, he'd been everywhere. You name it, he'd been locked up in it. He'd had the birch, the cat, the whole lot. Finally, he'd broken out of Broadmoor, broken into a house, and terrorised an old couple by threatening to kill them with an axe. This was how he earned that terrifying nickname, the Mad Axeman. Just a note here. Not only would you recognise that particular incident from an Only Fools and Horses episode, but just as we go on here with the comparisons to the Crays and looking for Mickey, I just want to also add that some of the writing for John Sullivan came from real life stories. For instance, the chandelier episode in Only Fools and Horses, the classic where it drops, that was actually a true story. So writers do obviously draw upon real life things that they've heard about that may not have even made the press. But I digress. So this was how he earned that terrifying nickname, the Mad Axeman. Soon he was recaptured and sentenced to life. That decision always struck me as lunatic in itself. Here is a guy who's been locked up in Broadmoor because he's criminally insane. He breaks out and commits a criminally insane act, but when he's convicted, the judge decides he was sane after all, and packs him off to an ordinary jail. Now tell me who's mad. By 1966, Frank had been in Dartmoor for 9 years, which was about the stretch normally served for a life sentence, so what he wanted was a guaranteed date for his release. When you've been in the nick as long as Frank, a date is something special. He had built up a special relationship with the governor of Dartmoor, who had made him a kind of promise, a verbal commitment. According to Frank, the governor had said he would urge the Home Office to give him a date. Whether it was immediate or a couple of years ahead didn't really matter. All Frank wanted was a date to focus his mind on. But months went by, nothing was heard back from the Home Office, and so the governor had nothing to tell Frank. So Frank is raging, because now he feels the governor's promise isn't worth the paper it isn't written on. Then in flies the good fairy, Ronald Cray. Our Ronnie now makes his own promise to Frank along these lines. Okay, we'll get you out, but you've got to stay out for 6 months. During this time, you write to a few top people. We'll give you their names, so they can get public opinion rolling on your side and bring pressure on the authorities to guarantee you a release date. The idea behind the six-month period was that if Mitchell could stay out that long without committing violence or any other crimes, then he could morally force the Home Office into giving him his date. Well, I'd never heard of anyone escaping from a British jail, giving himself up and then coming out sooner than if he'd never escaped. Escaping is a crime in itself, which means you always get time added on, not deducted. So when I heard that Ron had fed Mitchell this story, I knew it didn't add up. Anyway, who was this R. Cray Esquire to make promises on behalf of the authorities that he couldn't fulfil? Not even the Home Secretary could get away with this kind of deal, so how could an East End hoodlum? Yet, ludicrous as it sounds, that was the deal the twins had persuaded Mitchell to believe. He didn't think it was ludicrous because to him Ronnie was God. To us in the firm, Ronnie wasn't God. He was a crazy man who thought he was God. We also knew he had a habit of changing his mind and forgetting his promises. We were usually relieved he'd forgotten them, especially when it meant we didn't have to go out and kill somebody on his list. So when we heard this guff about springing Big Frank, we all thought it was just talk. None of us believed it would ever happen. Lo and behold, I went round the house one day and the twins were seriously discussing it. Then they announced we were really going to pick Mitchell up. It wasn't going to be a great escape, no daring do drop over high prison walls, because most days Big Frank was let out of the prison as a most trusted member of an outside party working on a council rubbish tip. Even better, to keep him quiet, the screw would allow him to go off and feed the wild ponies with bread that he had saved up in the prison. He'd walk miles from the other prisoners, but he'd always show up again. So even if he was half an hour late, the screw would not think of raising the alarm. On escape day, he would be picked up by car within that half hour and whisked off to Crayland. We had to get a move on because it was coming up to December, when the outside working parties would soon be suspended for the rest of the winter, and Frank would be brought back inside. But for a few more days we were all right. Two of our guys went down on a final visit to make precise arrangements with Frank about the time and place for the pickup. As he had roamed all over Dartmoor and knew it so well, he was able to give them the perfect spot. The pickup itself was given to me because I hadn't visited Frank for months, so I was unlikely to be identified. The driver would be a completely strange face, Mad Teddy Smith, who had never been down at all. So early on Monday 12th of December, me and Teddy headed off to Devon in a grey Humber, which Billy Exley had hired. We found the pickup point with no difficulty. It was a phone box by a T-junction, close to the Elephant's Nest public house near Peter Tavey. We had to meet him there at midday, and at just 12:10 he came walking round the corner. He was all on his own, and he got straight in the car. He wasn't particularly excited or elated. He was just quiet and relieved, confused and surprised, because I don't think he believed this would ever really happen. These kind of people love to sit and talk and plan, but they still don't think the escape will ever take place. If you've been in prison as long as Mitchell had, you can no longer separate fantasy from reality. As we drove off, we couldn't help fearing the whistle would go up almost straight away, and there would be instant roadblocks on every route off the moor. But the screw in charge of the working party must have been scurrying all over the moor, trying to find Frank before he dared report him missing, because he knew he would get into terrible trouble for allowing the mad axeman to wander off on his own. So that would have been one delay in raising the alarm, and then the prison bosses would have squirmed with embarrassment and disbelief for a few minutes before they dared call the local police. Then the police would have taken some time to raise the manpower for the roadblocks before doing the widening cordon routine, first 5 miles, then 10, and all that time we were driving on home. We'd brought along a change of clothing for Frank, an old suit, shirt, socks, shoes and a tie. We'd got them off Big Tommy Brown, the ex-fighter, who was just about the same size. Frank changed in the car, shedding all his Dartmoor gear, an old khaki anorak, blue jeans, gum boots, scarf, prison shirt and underclothes, and a beret. He also had a long homemade knife, which he'd brought along for self-defence. He didn't want to give this to me, but I said, "The whole reason you're out is so you do not get involved in any violence. Then you can write to various people, and they will work on your behalf to get you a release date. So the last thing you want is any tools on you, so let's get rid of them." Then we took the knife off him, and I told him that even without the knife, there was to be no violence. If we were stopped at a police roadblock, we would have to split up, and then he would be on his own. This was all true, and it made common sense, but I still had to kid to him. It was like talking to a naughty boy. Then he settled down. We put all his prison clothing into his anorak, tied the neck strings in the arms so that it formed a bundle, and stuck the knife in the middle. I then slung the lot over a hedge.
Bastards. I ain't going back until I've got a definite and reasonable release date, Deb. I ain't. I'll kill anybody who tries to make me.
That ain't very clever, is it, Mickey? I mean, there's hundreds of them out there, thousands. Coppers, army, God knows who. Well, you can't kill them all. And you'll be an idiot even to think of hurting anyone in your position. And they'd definitely throw away the key.
I've got this idea, haven't I, Deb? Deezer and the Shovel give it me.
What idea?
Gonna make a protest, ain't I? Gonna write letters to the newspapers, telling them what liberties have been taken with me. Gonna demand a, inquiry like.
Just like that?
ain't the lunatic they make out, Dib. I've been Miss... Geezer told me the word. Miss...
Represented. Misrepresented.
Yeah. Misrepresented. In the papers and that.
And you think, if you tell them that, they're going to be more sympathetic to you?
Got to try, ain't I, Dib? Got to try.
Once we got through Andover, 150 miles away, we knew we were safe. No problem. We were well out of it. Throughout the journey, Frank had been listening to a transistor radio he'd brought along, but nothing came up about his escape until we were already back in London. It was 4:30, and we were in Fulham when we heard the news that he'd been reported missing. While we were in Fulham, by the way, nice mention of Fulham there, another minder connection. While we were in Fulham, I phoned Reggie over at Valence Road. Using our usual simple code, I said, "That horse won," so he knew everything was all right. We took Frank to a place in Priscilla Road at Bow, where we were just going to hide him for the time being. It was the home of Nobby Clark's parents. Nobby and Scotch Jack Dixon were waiting for us, but when we knocked on the door, out came Nobby looking terrified. It turned out that this little rat had volunteered his mum and dad's flat so he could look big in Ronnie's eyes, but all the time never thinking this would ever happen. So when he saw Frank with us, he said, "Oh, you can't go in there, the old man's not well." Then he said, "It's been changed, we got a new address." And he gave me a piece of paper with a number in Barking Road written on it. So we had to head off to this gaff near Canning Town, where a little guy named Lenny Dunn lived on his own. We called him Lenny the Books because he had a bookstall on Whitechapel Waste. Near Bow Bridge we got tied up in a bit of traffic. As we drove slowly past a particular turning, by way of conversation I said, "You know that one, Frank, that's Old Ford Road." I shouldn't have done that because his parents lived there, so naturally he wanted to see them, but we had to keep him with us. He was getting excited, but we quietened him down. Between 5:30 and 6:00, we reached Lenny's flat and took him up. We watched the 6:00 news, then me and Teddy Smith left Frank there with Scotch Jack and Lenny. We drove back to the twins at Valence Road and told them what had happened. Then we each went home. We had been up since 6, and I was shattered after what had been a pretty tense operation, even for someone reasonably calm like myself. I was glad to have a night indoors. I woke to find we were being treated as heroes by other members of the firm. All I had done was babysit the guy on the drive back, but everyone was impressed, because when the papers got hold of it, they blew it up as if there was a lunatic ape man rushing round Dartmoor, and no one was safe in their beds. I think they had the Marines out for 3 days combing Dartmoor for him, when he was far away in London watching it all on the box. I remember a Giles cartoon, with 3 or 4 Marines crossing a bridge over a stream, and there's this big hulk underneath looking up, with his hands down to his ankles. Far from being offended, Frank was excited by the coverage. He thought that all this fuss was good for his cause. Now, I already knew from handling Big Frank that he wasn't as bad as the papers were painting him, but he was obviously nowhere near normal. In the next few days, we had to handle him very carefully. Here was a man who had been locked up nearly all his life. He was totally institutionalised. He was simple, he was big, he was hugely strong, and he had been clinically diagnosed as a nutter. And now we've ended up with him in a little flat, and he starts performing. You imagine, if all the psychiatrists and screws can't control this guy, what chance have the twins got? To start, we had to get on with writing these letters. That was down to the driver on the Dartmoor trip, Mad Teddy Smith. He thought he was a bit of a writer. He said plays of his had been broadcast on the radio. So he spent a lot of time with Frank, composing letters in Frank's name. In the one that appeared in the Times, Frank explained that he felt like a dog that had been given a bad name. He had escaped to draw attention to his unhappy plight and to win a release date. "From the age of 9, I have not been completely free, always under some act or other. Sir, I ask you, what is the fairness of this? I am not a murderer or a sex maniac, nor do I think I am a danger to the public. I think I have been more than punished for the wrongs I have done."
See how this sounds now. "Sir, I had it away from Chelmsford Prison in order to..."
"Hold on. Escape to be better than had it away, don't you think?"
"Yeah, definitely."
"Oh, yeah, yeah. More proper, like, you mean?"
"Yeah, yeah."
"Escaped, right.
Sir, I escaped from Chelmsford Prison in order to bring to the attention my diabolical situation.
I don't know about diabolical. Well, it is diabolical, isn't it?
Yeah, but what Terry means is that you have to word these things in the right sort of terms, less, well, provoking.
Yeah, sort of diplomatic, you know.
Oh.
Why not put unhappy situation?
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
Right. Unhappy. Bring the attention my unhappy situation.
Full stop.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, what I'm after is a possible date of release.
Shall I underline that bit?
No, I wouldn't, no. From the age of 10, because I've got no family, I've been locked away in some institution or other under this or that act, and I don't think it's fair, sir. I am not a sex maniac, nor a murderer, nor am I not a danger to the public like what they say. I have been more than punished for what I did. Yours sincerely, Mickey Dixon.
Yeah, well, it's like what I put in the letter, isn't it? It's all been a distortion of the facts. And I just want an opportunity to put my side of things for a change. Tell it like it is, you know. I've been treated very unfairly by the authorities. Been treated very unfairly by the authorities. And I'm not mad. And I don't want to spend the rest of my life dubbed up in prison and die there an old man without the chance. Well, that's all I've got to say for now. Is that all right?
This was how Frank was expressing himself to absolute strangers. But what was he saying to his dearest friends, Ronnie and Reggie? Well, nothing to Ronnie, because Ronnie never came to see him. As for Reggie, I took him to Frank on the one occasion he bothered or dared to visit him. It was partly to discuss the letters and partly to discuss getting Frank a girl. He was obviously busting for one, and we thought a bit of female company would keep him occupied and calm him down. We brought Tommy Cowley in on this because he often went to Winston's nightclub and knew a lot of the hostesses there. He thought one girl in particular would be just right for Frank, so Reggie and me and Tommy all went up to Winston's to see her. She was Lisa Prescott, and she was very pretty. I remember seeing her before when she worked at the Bagatelle. Then she was pretending to be Swedish, but she was really from up north. This night she'd had a few drinks, but as the three of us sized her up and talked it over, we agreed with Tommy that she seemed a sensible girl, and she'd keep her mouth shut. Not that we told her anything, except that we wanted her to take care of a good-looking friend of ours. She would have to look after him for a day or two, but she'd be paid well. Reggie and I agreed I wasn't going to tell her exactly what was going on until I'd got her into Lenny's flat. Then I'd spring it on her. She must have thought she could trust us, and she got in a cab with us. I dropped Reggie and Tommy off at Valence Road, and Lisa carried on to the flat with me. I knew that if she rebelled at any point after meeting Frank, or if she wanted to walk straight out, she would have to be detained. But I also knew that she'd have to know the full form on this guy once she'd met him. If she'd seen the TV or read any newspapers in the previous few days, she was bound to have known about the lunatic they'd been calling the Mad Axeman. There was no point in pussyfooting about the guy's identity. Now, obviously, this goes into great detail on what happened to Big Frank, hence Big Frank meets the Big Sleep. I won't read it all, it's a good few more pages, and we're going beyond the Minder connection. However, I do recommend you buy the book and read the whole of it, because it's very good. But I will just read the last few pages of this chapter, because there are also some interesting parts, and also some slight Minder connections. Long story short from the chapter, Mitchell is killed by the twins, or by people connected to him. Now, going back over who knew what and when, I really had no idea they were going to kill Mitchell, right up to the start of the shooting. I just didn't know. When we had that meeting in Hopwood's place with Reggie, Charlie Cray and Freddie Foreman, neither Hopwood nor me could hear the conversation. That must have been when the plot was agreed, but all I was told was only that we had to get him in the van, separate him from the woman, and take him down to a farm in Kent for Christmas with Ronnie. This was how the twins always treated individuals on the firm. For security reasons, you would never be told the whole story. You would be given just part of it. Say you would be told to go and see a certain person, to slap or frighten him. Then later you'd find out that somebody else had been doing something entirely different. And only when you matched these two things together could you understand what the twins had been aiming at all along. Not so much divide and rule as divide and confuse, to minimise the risk of grousing. Again, I'll just miss out a slight part of the text and get to this next part. It took some time for me to get to tell Ronnie exactly what had happened, because he was tucked away in over a bric-a-brac or antique shop in Fulham. Antique shop, Fulham. Eventually we went there and I told him all about it. He already knew a lot because Reggie used to phone him up and visit him frequently, but I had to give him all the fine details. He was so interested that I had to tell him everything three or four times. He was getting such a thrill out of it, he kept asking me, "Tell us again, how did he look, what did he say?" He had a crazy interest in it. He was drunk at the time, but drunk or sober, he was always mad. And now we have to start spreading the rumours. We were told to say he had gone abroad. Frank's in France and this, that and the other. And somebody was sent back to settle the guy whose flat it was, little Lenny the Books. Somebody had to calm him down, and that was it. In a few weeks, everybody forgot about it. They never did find Frank's body. Where they took it, only they know to this day. There's been all sorts of nonsense about him holding up the motorway. But 2 or 3 weeks later, I was given the job of taking £1,000 to Freddie Foreman's pub, the Prince of Wales, in the Borough, just south of London Bridge. When I got there, Fred was upstairs in the living quarters, so I went up, gave him the money, and he started talking. He said that when they took Frank to pieces, they were surprised that for such a big man, he had such a small brain, and he cupped his hands to show me. And he described how his heart was all ripped and torn from the 3 bullets that went through it. They must have dismembered him to see all that stuff. Some people have suggested this was to get the bullets out, so that if the remains, even just ashes, were ever found, no one could tie the bullets to the guns. But to me it would have been far easier to smash up the guns or send somebody on a day trip to France and chuck them over the side. Foreman said one more bullet had stuck in his silencer, so that gun wasn't worth keeping anyway. From what else he told me, I gather they had to keep Mitchell's body laid up somewhere for 5 days because they couldn't deliver it straight away to where they got rid of it, because the fellow who owned the place had visitors over the Christmas. Foreman didn't tell me where this was. I only know what he chose to tell me. They burned him, that's all. A few days after this conversation, I had a chat with Charlie Cray. He said, "I was talking to Fred the other day and I asked him how he'd got on. He said he was pleased. You were all right, you'd done your job, no panic." I said, "No panic, I was shitting myself. I thought I was going to go." Then Charlie laughed, but again he and Freddie deny this. So I didn't disappear along with Mitchell, but sometime later my colleague on the Dartmoor run did evaporate. Mad Teddy Smith, he was the one that wrote the letters. Mad Teddy Smith had a row with Ronnie Cray while they were both down at the caravan site at Steeple Bay. He was never seen again. His last known work as an author did not go unappreciated. A second of his letters from Frank appeared in the Daily Mirror and drew a sympathetic plea from the editor to take the man-to-man advice I am offering you. This was to keep your word and surrender at once. By doing so, you will strengthen your claim that you are entitled to a fresh consideration of your case. We've given you a fair hearing, Frank Mitchell. Now give yourself up. But Frank couldn't give himself up, because he was murdered the day those words were published. I don't know if he even had a chance to read them. Man-to-man advice to him that day consisted of so many bullets in his head. Whatever happened to his remains, and to Mad Teddy Smith, at least one more corpse was on the way, and many more were in the planning. First, how did Tony Hoare seem to know the intimate details of the Frank Mitchell story? Hoare was the writer for this episode, and Terry Green was the director. Before continuing with all the other aspects that I want to connect, it's just worth mentioning that the name Mickey Dixon is interesting anyway, because there was a Jack Dixon, or John Dixon, who later wrote a book. He was actually someone who testified against the Crays later. and he was blacked out in an interview, and he was a getaway driver. Now that will become rather interesting as we go on, because so was Tony Hoare. And just while we're on the subject of connecting names, it may be a tenuous link as she was probably already named, but Debbie is actually called Debbie Mitchell. That's her full name is Deborah Mitchell. And of course Debbie is in this episode, and Mitchell was the surname of Frank Mitchell. Is that a coincidence? We shall see. As I say, how did Tony Hoare seem to know the intimate details of the Frank Mitchell story? It had obviously been in the newspapers, so perhaps he either remembered what had happened, or possibly still had some of the articles. Some writers do keep stories just in case they ever need inspiration. The details are so precise, however, that I can't help feeling Tony Hoare knew a little more than the average News of the World reader. Remember, before becoming a television writer, Tony Hoare spent much of his early life in prison for robbing banks. He was born in 1938, so would have been roughly the age of many of those involved in the crazed story during the mid-60s. You start to wonder who he met in prison. I'll just read an excerpt from his obituary. Tony Hoare was born in Oxford in 1938. His father worked in a ball bearings factory, and his mother was a waitress in one of the colleges. The family later moved to Luton, where Hoare grew up. He was a bright scholar and might have gone on to college, but on leaving school he went to London in search of excitement. He found it as the member of a gang of bank robbers. They were never very successful. After a job in Warrington, they repaired to a nearby pub, but their southern accents immediately gave them away and they were arrested. Although a terrible driver, Hoare was the getaway man. He could reflect that he made far more money writing about crime for television than from his own crimes. For much of the 1960s, he was in and out of prison. He made headlines when he escaped from a high-security jail in Liverpool, had a spell in solitary confinement in Dartmoor, and ended up in Hull, where he got a job in the library, read a lot, and started writing. He ran a magazine called Contact, with the emphasis on the con, and wrote a novel which won an Arthur Kessler Award. Now, hold on a second. Note the similarity there between Hoare's obituary and the Mad Mickey story, plus the Frank Mitchell story. Hoare escaped from a jail in Liverpool, ended up in Dartmoor, yes, the very same prison Frank Mitchell escaped from. Now, prisoners do get moved around, so going from Liverpool to Dartmoor is not too unusual, but it is some coincidence. Hoare came up with a play called The Chaps, slang for villains, which Alan Plater showed to friends in the business, and after Hoare was released from Hull, it was produced for television. Despite a further spell in prison for driving while disqualified, Hoare's writing career quickly took off. Hoare was often asked where he got his ideas from, and he had no convincing answer, though he tended to agree that writers often do their best work under pressure. He cited a minor commission in 1982 when his life was falling apart. He had been ejected from the family home, was living out of his car and cadging beds from friends, but the script got written. Now, while researching Tony Hoare a little bit more, I came across a very interesting post from a man called Lawrence Flood. This was written in 2015. Here is what he said. Tony went from bad to good on his own talent. I shared time with Tony in Hull, read all of his piles of school exercise books. All the right guys recognised Tony's talent, as did Mr. Plater. Tony was and is a diamond. Hull at that time housed a few infamous names. Jimmy Hussey, train robbery, the Richardson mob, a couple of cray henchmen, and many more, blaggers, killers, a great blackboard for Tony's writing. R.I.P. Tony, many happy years following your travels. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, interesting to think about who Tony may have met in prison. I wrote that before reading this post, and then here I come across a couple of cray henchmen apparently met him in Hull Prison. Well, it makes sense based on everything we've said. Now this is only on a forum, and may or may not be true, but it is again some coincidence that he mentions the craze. Hull is not exactly the type of place you would expect groups of London criminals to gather, which leads me to believe it is true. When I checked, it was quick and easy to find everyone from Tony Lambriani, a craze associate who was sent to Hull Prison, to Trevor Ownsworth, a self-confessed nutter gangster and associate of the craze. Then there is another Mad Frankie Fraser, part of the rival Richardson gang. He spent time in Hull Prison. Another intriguing mention must go to a phrase used by Albert Donoghue a few times in his book. He refers to the violent gangster types as flatnoses. Obvious, of course, given most of them were fighting quite regularly. Boxers often have flat noses too, though incidentally neither Cray brother had a flat nose. But I tell you who did, Mr. Tony Hoare. Other connections in the Minder episode to the Cray story include the obvious similarity between Debbie, played of course by Diana Mallin, and Lisa Prescott, the woman who had been provided to Mitchell to keep him company. And just let me reiterate, Debbie Mitchell was created, as far as I can tell, by Tony Hoare, who was her boyfriend at some point during the writing of Minder. Her very first episode in Minder, Come In T64, Your Time Is Ticking Away, was written by Tony Hoare, and four of her five episodes were written by him also. Only the last one that she appeared in was not written by him, by which time obviously she'd become a well-established Minder character.
Anyway, don't worry about it. Arthur came to me and suggested I help sort things out for you, so you get your bits and pieces together and we'll be on our way.
Don't listen to him, Mickey. Arthur won't go to him. He's up to something.
Birds, Mickey. What do they know? We go back a long time. Would I put you in it?
It's all right, Debbie. I mean, Freddie's one of the chaps. Anyway, Father says it's all right.
Oh, you're a fool, Mickey. A bloody fool.
Back to Lisa Prescott. If you look at her photo, there is a certain resemblance to Debbie. The episode also made a point of showing it was winter. Debbie's jumper looks very Christmassy. And you can see as Mickey does the cross-country running when he's escaping, you can see his breath and it looks rather cold. Remember, the Frank Mitchell story took place in December. Although Debbie's flat doesn't look too much like the flat where Mitchell was kept with Lisa Prescott, the interior does. Although I should say most places probably look like this in the 60s and 70s. But there is a strange similarity between the real flat and the block of flats on the Mendip estate in Wandsworth. Check out the scene between Chisholm and Jones as they look for Mickey. The flats look very similar indeed. Of course, all of this could be coincidence, but not when you consider the core details of both the plot and the Frank Mitchell story. And if we were left in any doubt as to whether this episode referenced the Crays, there is the character of Freddie Baker, played by John Moffat. Firstly, the name of Freddie. This could have been a mention of Freddie Foreman, who, as we have seen, was very much involved. And Freddie Baker's house? Well, it's only a terraced, distinctly like the famous terraced house the Cray brothers lived in. And who does Baker live with but his mother? Anyone who has ever looked into the Crays won't go too far before learning about their mother, Violet. Moffat, incidentally, appeared in the original Murder on the Orient Express. Not quite Minder. It's all a bit strange when you really think about it. Last Cray's connection for you. In the Looking for Mickey episode, there is an appearance from Terence Plummer, who was in three Minder episodes altogether. He also appeared in five episodes of The Sweeney. But his very last film appearance was in Sexy Beast, which starred, of course, Ray Winston. That will be the same Ray Winston who was Arnie in Minder, and who often describes the story of weeing on Ronnie Cray when he was a baby. You really couldn't make this up.
Chisholm has a disturbingly suspicious nature. There's no point in hanging around just to be asking good questions. Oh, my good God.
Something on your mind, Terry?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, you wear glasses, you must have bad eyes. You ought to have them out.
It's just his joke, Freddy. He don't mean nothing by it.
That's very funny, Terry. That's very humorous. It's a pity so many comedians get to be so unhappy in their personal lives.
No, the boy's upset.
Oh, upset, is he?
Yeah, well, you know what it's like when plod starts agging you, you get a bit edgy, don't you? Goodness me, is that the time? Come on, Terry, we'll be late.
Leave it out, Arthur. This slag knows what upset me.
You know, the last time someone spoke to me like that, Terry, was the last time they spoke.
You are a scum.
Well, well, this is a jolly little gathering. Some problem, is there?
Oh, no. No problem, Mr. Chisholm. No problem at all.
Seems to me, Jones, what we have here, if these gentlemen don't move on, is a clear case of obstruction of a public highway.
Aye. Something like that, Gov.
Oh, well, we wouldn't want to break the law, Mr. Chisholm. Would we, Terry?
So let me know if you enjoyed this episode deep dive. It wasn't planned, and it was possibly slightly different from what someone may have expected from looking deep into the episode, but I'm only sharing with you what I found, and I find it very convincing and very intriguing. I thought it was too good to just move on and not tell you all about it once I'd read the book. Take a look at the Minder Podcast website for this episode to see some of the photos that I've been talking about, and then things really start to come together and make more sense. Here's my conclusion for what it's worth after looking at everything. I think that Tony Hoare possibly exaggerated some of his misdemeanours in the past. I think one way or another Tony Hoare came across very notorious criminals when he was in prison. And I think that it's possible that he's either referring to Jack Dixon as the getaway driver, or indeed himself, as he was said to be a getaway driver. If not, it's a combination of maybe both men's backgrounds and stories. I think that most of the things I pointed out were deliberate, very cleverly done, and I don't believe anywhere has it ever been pointed out that there is a huge similarity between this episode and the Craze situation with Frank Mitchell. So it was about time we drew attention to it. Who knows what I can come across next for other episodes. Please come back next time for another episode, and I'll be reading out some reader emails and also telling you a little bit about the agents I've been dealing with. That's a story in itself, and many of you write in to ask for requests for certain people. I've either already contacted them or I tend to follow your request, and I'll tell you all about what happens when I do that next time. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. Cheers. And don't have nightmares.